Welcome to Pirate Money Radio with your host, Kevin Freeman, helping you unpack the economic headlines and providing real money solutions.
Hey, good morning, Saturday. It's a wonderful day. And we're talking today about the petrodollar. You may have heard of that. It was in the news. It's been in the news quite a bit recently. We're going to walk through the history of what is a petrodollar. Is it a myth? Is it a real thing? Why is it in the news today? It dates back apparently 50 years. So welcome, Mike Carter. Let's talk petrodollar.
All right, petrodollar. I like talking gold better, but let's talk petrodollar, what that means to the real dollar. And, you know, I remember, I know it's tied some to, you know, our Federal Reserve status. And early on when we were working things in the war room, I remember a stat once that if the U.S. were to lose their Federal Reserve status, it could be a 40% hit to the economy overnight.
Yeah.
Does this tie to all that?
It is tied to all that. The petrodollar is, let me quote from dailytimes.com. The U.S. dollar has reigned supreme as the world's reserve currency for decades, a power fueled by the petrodollar system. This is June 25th, 2024. The petrodollar system refers to the arrangement where oil is primarily traded in U.S. dollars. This seemingly simple concept has a profound impact on the global economy and political landscape for decades. But whispers of a changing landscape are growing louder. De-dollarization, the process of reducing reliance on the dollar, is gaining traction, potentially reshaping the global financial order. And yet, what you just said was it could have an overnight 40% impact on the American economy.
Well, I don't know if the petrodollar could, but if we lose that reserve currency, yeah, that's significant. That gets my attention.
Yeah, well, here, I'll go on and keep reading. The story of the petrodollar's rise and reign began in the 1970s following the collapse of the Bretton Woods system. Bretton Woods system, here's what happened. Most people used the pound sterling, the British pound, as the reserve currency of the world up through World War I, and then it started to shift, and America seemed a little more important power relative to Britain, and as time went on into World War II, they got more and more in debt to us, and we started taking the ascendance with the petrodollar. And we called it the Bretton Woods system. People got together at Bretton Woods and agreed that the U.S. dollar would be the primary reserve currency of the world. But let me keep reading. It said, following the collapse of the Bretton Woods system, the U.S. negotiated a landmark agreement with Saudi Arabia. The foundation of the petrodollar system was laid in the aftermath of World War II. The U.S. emerged as a dominant economic power with a strong dollar backed by a large gold reserve. Meanwhile, oil-rich countries like Saudi Arabia needed a stable currency for their booming oil exports. A pivotal moment occurred in 1971 when President Nixon ended the convertibility of U.S. dollar to gold, effectively severing the direct link between the dollar and its gold backing. Oil, the world's lifeblood, would be priced and traded exclusively in dollars. This, as explained in a 2024 Atlantic Council article, what the end of the petrodollars means. And that secured the dollar's dominance as the petrodollar. Now, Atlantic Council is not some conspiracy theory site. One would argue it is the leading globalist site to explain currencies. That's where we turn. We're wanting information on central bank digital currencies and so forth. It's considered reputable. I'm not sure I consider it reputable, but the world considers the Atlantic Council reputable. And they say there really is such a thing called the petrodollar.
Okay.
Well, how did that come about? In the article that I just quoted from, they talked about the Bretton Woods dollar system. Let's just go back in time. Let's go back to 1965, right? 1965. I was 4 years old. That's a long time ago. But in 1965, I got a Time magazine out of the archives.
Something tells me you were, how old were you? Four years old? Something tells me you were probably reading Time magazine back then. I know you. That and your economist handbook.
Well, I had to go down into the vault and pull out my original edition copy from February 12th, but it was there. Yeah. It was a little slow reading for me back in 1965. I preferred something a little... No, I'm kidding.
You had your Spider-Man as well, but your comic book, but I know you had all those geeky books too.
Yeah, I was pretty geeky. Yeah, you got me on that one. All right, quoting February 12th, 1965. This is straight from that article. Perhaps never before had a chief of state launched such an open assault on the monetary power of a friendly nation. The title of the article is Francis de Gaulle, Charles de Gaulle from World War II, wanted to undo the dollar system. That's 1965. So we're talking, what, 59 years ago, almost 60 years ago. Nor had anyone of such stature made so sweeping a criticism of the international monetary system since its founding in 1944. There was Charles de Gaulle last week proclaiming that the primacy of the dollar in international dealings was finished.
So we've heard this before.
Yeah, we've heard it before. Calling for an eventual return to the gold standard, which the world's nations scrapped 50 years ago, and practically inviting other countries to follow France's lead and cash in their dollars for gold. It was a particularly nettling irritant, just as the U.S. was deeply involved in making some hard decisions about its monetary policy. Just before de Gaulle spoke, Treasury Secretary Douglas Dillon made the first public admission that the U.S. payments deficit in 1964 moved higher than anyone had expected. Guess what our payment deficit was? It totaled $3 billion.
Wow, even adjusted for inflation, that sounds like a good deal.
Yeah, $3 billion. You know, in today's money, we spend that.
That's about what many burgers McDonald's sold probably back then.
We spend $3 billion in seconds, you know, here. The federal government, $3 billion isn't even a rounding error. It's too small. It's the pocket change of the couch of the Federal Reserve. All right, all of which the U.S. is legally committed to exchange for U.S. gold on demand. The Federal Reserve announced that the gold supply declined last week by $100 million to a 26-year low of $15.1 billion. Charles de Gaulle, the head of France, was worried about endless American nonsense wars, and he was worried that America was bankrupt. So I pulled up a clip from a Frenchman who is explaining to us what de Gaulle was feeling back in 1965 through 1971, I think. So play that clip if you could.
First of all, because Charles de Gaulle was watching the Americans doing their Vietnam War. And he saw, he was a military, you know, he saw what is the price of every bullet, of every cannon, of every airplane and everything, and mostly the salary of all the soldiers up there, you know? So he know that this is extremely expensive, you know? And there is nothing in Vietnam to take, you know, except rice. So it was a nonsense war, basically. So Charles de Gaulle understood perfectly that the only way that first the Americans were already bankrupt because they printed more money, more dollars, than they had gold in Fort Knox. He saw that, of course.
All right, so there you got it. Charles de Gaulle was worried that we'd get involved in nonsense wars like Vietnam would end up losing. And he said that we were printing too much money. That was 1965.
And we didn't have the gold to back it.
Wow,
and that was with a, what was the deficit again?
Well, then we had a $3 billion U.S. payments deficit, which is slightly different than the federal government deficit. But nevertheless, bottom line is that Charles de Gaulle was worried because he knew how much it cost to pay bullets and soldiers and so forth. And America was involving themselves in all these foreign wars, printing too much money and didn't have the gold to back it. You know, we played the clip here before where Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell, you know, what do you do when you need stuff? Oh, we print money. We create it digitally, of course. Do you have that clip back there? Jerome Powell, it was basically asked by 60 Minutes, what do you do? How do you solve problems in America at the Federal Reserve? What are the kind of things that you do? And he just said, basically, we print money. You got it?
You know, history repeats itself. It's hard to believe that we're seeing the same thing over again, just at different scales, but it's a much bigger scale right now.
Yeah, it is. Well, we're going to have to take a break before when we come back, we'll have that clip for you. But the bottom line is, in the 1960s and in the early 70s, France was worried America was spending too much money. We're spending too much money now. France was worried that America didn't have gold to back up the money they were printing. We're running out of gold now. All of those things are repeating. History is rhyming. We'll be back right after a break, and we'll hit it hard.
Welcome back to Pirate Money Radio with your host, Kevin Freeman.
Yeah, and we're talking about the petrodollar, how it came to be, and will it can remain to be or not to be on the petrodollar? That is the question. All right, so before the break, we were talking about Charles de Gaulle, who was the head of France, and he had complained that America was spending too much money in nonsense wars, and he'd complained that we would just print money when we didn't have any gold to back it. And so that was then. What about right now? What does the Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell say about what the Federal Reserve does when we encounter a crisis? Roll that clip.
You simply flooded the system with money.
Yes, we did.
So to lend to a bank, we simply use the computer to mark up the size of the account that they have with the Fed. So it's much more akin, although not exactly the same, but it's much more akin to printing money than it is to borrowing.
You've been printing money.
Well, effectively.
Where does it come from? Do you just print it?
We print it digitally. So we as a central bank, we have the ability to create money digitally.
Flooding the system with money.
Yes, exactly.
And there's no end to your ability to do that.
There is no end to our ability to do that.
All right, that's what was bugging Charles de Gaulle. That's what was bugging France in 1965. So they started to demand the end of the dollar as the reserve currency of the world. That was France in 1965. That is BRICS nation in 2024. So what did de Gaulle do?
But we at least kind of pretended to have some gold backing to our money back then. We probably didn't even have the term digital back then. But now we're just literally printing it with nothing.
Yeah, well, the reason we ended the gold backing happened in 1971 when de Gaulle sent a French battleship. Let me read. It's a Columbia University paper, page 17. It says, in August 1971, French President Pompidou sent a battleship to New York Harbor to remove France's gold from the vault of the New York Federal Reserve Bank and to transport it to the Banque de France in Paris.
That's making a statement there. You're sending a battleship to pick up your gold.
Soon thereafter, gold accounted for 92% of French reserves. On August 11th, the British requested the Treasury remove the $3 billion of gold from the U.S. depository of Fort Knox to the New York Federal Reserve Vault, where the gold of foreign governments was stored. As Paul Volcker, who was then Treasury Undersecretary, he went on to be the head of the Federal Reserve, put it, if the British, who had founded the system with us and who had fought so hard to defend their own currency, were going to take their gold for their dollars, it was clear that the game was indeed over. When Nixon spoke on August 15, 1971, the U.S. had less than 10,000 tons of gold, less than half of what it once had. Nixon's August 1971 decisions caught foreign governments by complete surprise. They also surprised most U.S. policymakers and officials. We know what happened in 1971 August, right?
Yeah, we went off the gold standard.
That was it. From that day till the present, we've lost 90% of the purchasing power of the dollar because it's not backed by gold any longer. Nixon, though, was a very popular figure. I mean, we think of Richard Nixon in terms of Watergate. But in 1972, he won a landslide re-election. He was elected in 49 out of 50 states voted for him, and only one voted for George McGovern. That was, do you know which
Massachusetts?
One? Massachusetts, that's right. His predecessor, Lyndon Johnson, had a war on poverty that ran up deficits and a Vietnam War that was crushing America, and Nixon was promising to fix both. It made him very popular. Inflation had been in the 2% range for decades after World War II, but it had inched up by 1971 closer to 6%, and France was threatening to bankrupt America. Geez, low inflation for many years spikes up to 6%. Other nations upset with us for our warmonger strategies around the world. Other nations saying that the dollar is going to fall and we want to end the reserve currency status. Does that sound at all familiar to you, Mike?
It sounds very familiar, but the numbers back then seem so much more comfortable.
Oh, wow. We had $3 billion in... Yeah, exactly. No, you're exactly right. But then we also had the history. And this was from the 1950s when Richard Nixon was vice president under Eisenhower of what's known as the Suez Canal crisis. And I'll tell you a quick history on that. During the 1950s, we were worried that Egypt would fall into the Soviet Union's orbit. And Egypt was run by Nasser. And Nasser decided to nationalize the Suez Canal that had been built by the French and was managed by the British, and it was necessary for international trade. And so he said, I'm going to nationalize it. And the British and French threatened to send in troops to prevent him from stealing their stuff, right? They're going to steal it. And President Eisenhower, good Republican President Eisenhower, said, no, if you do that, we will ruin you, Britain. We will dump all our holdings of British bonds, and you will not be able to borrow money from the International Monetary Fund, and you will go broke. And the British and French had to let the Egyptians take their stuff.
That's where economic warfare made another launch.
Yeah, exactly. It didn't begin there, but it absolutely had an impact there. And Richard Nixon knew it. And Nixon knew we were over a barrel with our dollar and the risk that it happened, the threat that it happened. You know, 20 years after Nixon took us off the gold standard, approximately, a guy named George Soros figured out that you could break the Bank of England. He came and short sold British bonds and took advantage and made himself a billionaire in the process. The Chinese called that an act of financial warfare. But at the time of Nixon, he had a tough decision. You either stop the gold outflow and implement wage and price controls, which is what he did to try and stem inflation. He was kind of borrowing what FDR did in gold confiscation.
I had not thought of it from that perspective.
Yeah, 1933 gold, FDR, why did he confiscate?
Because he felt they were hoarding the gold and we needed to, you know, get money moving back in the system again.
Right, and so Nixon was worried that other nations were going to be hoarding gold, taking their gold, following France's, and they said, oh no, we can't do that. So he essentially confiscated the gold. He said, you can't take the gold out. He confiscated the gold. Now, the big question that comes from this, did the CIA go out and topple anti-dollar regimes? Because that's the claim. The claim is that after France got their gold, the CIA was sent out to any other nation that wanted to pull their gold, and they worked and they used color revolutions in those nations to prevent the leadership from taking the gold out of New York. Do you think that's true? That's a rumor. Do you think there's any validity to it?
It has more validity in my mind today than it would have back then.
Yeah, I don't know if it's true or not. I've had access to some really interesting information. I know this. I know that on March 22nd, 2011, on CNBC, there's a complaining article that Muammar Gaddafi in Libya had frozen assets and he was sitting on a pile of gold. He had 143.8 tons of gold, which is much more than America had when France came to get their gold, according to data from the International Monetary Fund. And they were worried because his reserves were in the top 25 of the world, and they were worried because there were rumors he was going to start an Pan-Africa-based gold-backed currency. So is that a rumor? Well, Foreign Policy Journal on January 6th, listen to this headline. Newly disclosed emails show that Libya's plan to create a gold-backed currency to compete with the euro and dollar was a motive for NATO's intervention. You know, when NATO intervened, who'd they kill? Muammar Gaddafi.
Yes.
All right. So these were in the Hillary emails, according to Foreign Policy. It says, most astounding is the lengthy section delineating the huge threat that Gaddafi's gold and silver reserves, estimated at 143 tons of gold. See, that's backing up what we just read from CNBC from 5 years prior, and a similar amount in silver posed to the French franc circulating as a prime African currency. In place of the noble-sounding responsibility to protect R2P doctrine fed to the public, there is this confidential explanation of what was really driving the war. Imagine that. They went to war over gold or silver or paper money. That's what the battle was over, at least according to this article. Is that a rumor? I don't know. It seems plausible, doesn't it?
It does. And the common theme is gold is the one that everybody wants. I don't see them not Bitcoin right now. It's not a similar form of currency. It seems like even in the 60s, gold was the king out there. Gold and probably silver, other precious metals.
Yeah. So here in Foreign Policy in 2016, the last line is, instead, the great fear reported is that Libya might lead North Africa into a high degree of economic independence with a new Pan-African currency. And what's not said there, gold-backed.
Mm-hmm.
So we see that from the BRICS nations now. But let's go back to 1973. All right. We've not exactly gotten to where
history's
the petrodollar...
History's still repeating itself, huh?
It is. History's rhyming. 1973, there was an Arab war against Israel. Oh, my goodness. That's not happening now. At least. Oh, well, maybe it is. All right. The Arab oil embargo of 1973 created gas lines here in America. Gas prices spiked. You and I weren't driving yet, but we saw our parents complaining about, do you remember the gas lines?
And I remember that. I remember my first car when I bought it. I was trying to figure out which kind of car to buy, and gas had jumped up to 60 cents a gallon. And my dad kept trying to tell me that every car I wanted had high performance, high horsepower. It's a gas guzzler. It's like, oh. 60 cents a gallon. I could have had a lot of gas guzzling fun.
Yeah, you could have. Those were the days to do it. But here's what happened in 1973. There were gas lines. And depending on your license plate number, odd or even as last digit, you could get gas one day and not the next day. It's kind of like the water restrictions that we have, you know, in my hometown now. Bottom line is there was an Arab oil embargo and there was a price spike. And so this is the context. We have France taking their gold. We have war in Vietnam. We have an Arab oil embargo and a war between Arab nations and Israel. We have American economy with inflation flat for the longest time, then spiking higher, as we've seen recently. These are the things that Richard Nixon was facing in the early 1970s. He'd ended the gold standard in 1971, and he doesn't know how to fix it. What do you do to support the U.S. dollar if it's no longer exchangeable for gold?
You shift to the petrodollar.
That's exactly right. He sent Henry Kissinger, who was the Secretary of State, and William E. Simon, who was the Treasury Secretary, to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, to negotiate. And I'd never met Henry Kissinger, but I did meet Bill Simon, and I had the opportunity to talk with him. And these are real things. These actually happened. They sent a team into Riyadh to negotiate because we were at great risk as a nation of losing our economic status as the world leader, and they needed to figure out something that would support the dollar, because otherwise we would go the way of all the other fiat currencies backed by nothing, unless we guaranteed that every nation in the world, or at least every nation that needed oil, would have to also have dollars to get that oil. And when they bought the oil from the very wealthy Saudi Arabian royalty, would Saudi Arabia put the money back in dollars? These are the elements that set the stage for the petrodollar that we have known all of our lifetime, but maybe, just maybe, going away. We'll explain it further right after this break.
Pirate Money Radio, helping you give, spend, and invest in ways that align with liberty, security, and values. Welcome back with your host, Kevin Freeman.
Yeah, and let me tell you where we are. We just hopped in the DeLorean, and we went back to 1971, 1972. The music's a little better than it is today. You still hear the Beatles, and it's not on the oldie stations. We're enjoying life here in the early 70s, but Richard Nixon wasn't enjoying life because he was watching the government strain to have Charles de Gaulle sent a battleship and took all the French gold home. He had to close the gold window. Inflation is roaring. We're in the midst of an Arab oil embargo. How do we support the dollar? Do you remember those days, Mike?
I remember them, not in detail. I was still just enjoying life back then. But yes, I do remember them.
Yeah, no, money was difficult and challenging there. I remember, I tell this joke, but it's absolute truth. My dad was a stockbroker in the early 70s, and the stock market was just terrible. 1973-74, among the worst stock markets in the history of the world. And he would come home at night and say, "What's for dinner, honey?" And my mom would say, "We have hamburger helper, but we don't have hamburger." And so
well, my mom was part of the problem because my dad came home and said, "I just invested in the stock market." And she was so mad at him. I remember it was like 73, 74 because the market had done well. And she was like, "We don't need to be putting anything in that. That's going nowhere." So
yeah, well, it was at the height 1,000 on the Dow, and the low point was 600 on the Dow. And of course, it's been around 40,000 recently. So in the long run, your dad was right. In the short term, it was probably pretty challenging. You know, people worry about what they do with their money. And here, there are only three things you can do with your money. You can give it, you can spend it, you can invest it. Here at Pirate Money Radio, we work to explain solutions that support all three areas that in ways that promote liberty, security, and values. Patriot Mobile, a mobile phone company, supports the Pirate Money Radio program. Patriot Mobile uses U.S. carriers, including AT&T, Verizon, and T-Mobile, and they operate on both Apple and Android phones. More information about the Economic War Room and Patriot Mobile is available at piratemoneyradio.com/AFR. That's piratemoneyradio.com/AFR. And if you had a mobile phone in your DeLorean in 1971, you were the rich of the rich of the rich.
Yeah, I knew one person. Well, I guess I was in the 70s. My father-in-law had a cell phone in his truck because he was an electrical contractor and needed it for work. Another guy in town had it in his Mercedes. So
yeah, rich people had them. They had the bag phones, or they had the big, that honking phone.
This was physically in the car. It was huge. The regular, like a phone handset in the car on the dash.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. All right. So in the 1970s, Henry Kissinger probably had a cell phone. William Simon probably had a cell phone. They get sent to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and they're going to negotiate with the king. And is this real or is it a rumor that they talk them into developing what's called a petrodollar? I want to read to you. Is it truth or conspiracy theory that the petrodollar is what gives the U.S. dollar its value? I've heard this conspiracy theory. Even for an anti-government skepticist such as myself, I find it hard to swallow and somewhat unbacked by research. Really? People think it's a conspiracy theory. I'm going to tell you it's not a conspiracy theory. I know it for a fact. I can't tell you exactly how I know it for a fact, but I can tell you what they did come up with, whether it was a formal agreement or an informal agreement. It was a meeting of minds, and they said to the king of Saudi Arabia, hey, you could probably use some American defense protection for your kingdom. We got this Arab oil embargo, and we got all this unrest, and we've got Islamic radicalism beginning to rise. Don't you want some protection from America? And the answer is, oh, yes. Yeah. Don't you want to guarantee that we're going to buy your oil? I mean, we've got a lot of oil in America, but we'll buy your oil. It'll be all right. And when we do buy it, or you sell it anywhere else, we'd like it if you'd price it in dollars, which was not an automatic at those days because we didn't have the gold to back the dollar anymore. It wasn't an automatic. Other nations were demanding that to turn in their dollars like France had done and get gold out instead. So absolutely, it was a real thing. And not only that, the third thing that we asked is, and by the way, when you make extra money, after you pay all of, build your palaces and do all your shopping in New York and everything else, that buy all the gold, fancy things that you're buying, we want you to put the extra money you've got into U.S. Treasury bonds, and that will be your reserve currency. That absolutely happened. People can deny it. They used to deny it all the time.
It all sounded like a deal. It was too good to be true until having to buy the treasuries again. But back then, that wasn't risky.
Yeah, no, well,
I guess it's not risky today.
I'm not going to diss Treasury bonds, but the point is, what, do you want to buy U.S. Treasury bonds or would you rather have French?
Right, right.
Or German or Japanese or whatever. So the bottom line is that we made an agreement, and that agreement, whether formal or informal, has lasted about 50 years from 1974 when they were sent over. And there's no question. Here's a quote from Morningstar. There's no question that it started and it's lasted about that time. But now, recently, there's been all this news, the petrodollar's ending. And I want to tell you, they're coming out as strongly to tell you it's not ending as they were telling you it never existed, which I just read a quote. Oh, no, no, that's a quote from 20 years ago. Oh, no, that never happened. Here's a quote from Morningstar.com. Stories about the collapse of long-standing petrodollar agreement between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia spread like wildfire on social media, but the agreement never existed. It seemed like big news, and many wondered why the mainstream media had seemingly ignored it. Turns out there was very good reason. Earlier this week, reports circulating widely on social media platforms like X offered up a shocking proclamation, a 50-year-old agreement between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia requiring that the latter price its crude oil exports in U.S. dollars had expired on Sunday. The collapse of the accord would inevitably deal a fatal blow to the U.S. dollar status as the de facto global reserve currency. Various commentators on X opined surely financial upheaval lay ahead. Almost immediately, Google searches for the term petrodollar spiked to the highest level on record dating back to 2004, according to Google Trends. But as speculation about an imminent end to the U.S. dollar's global dominance intensified, several Wall Street and foreign policy experts emerged to point out a fatal flaw in the logic. The agreement itself never existed, at least not in the way it was being described. Now, they go on and say, yeah, okay, the agreement never existed, but we kind of had an informal agreement. I'll read it. The agreement referred to by Donovan is the United States-Saudi Arabian Joint Commission on Economic Cooperation. It was formally established on June 8, 1974 by a joint statement issued and signed by Henry Kissinger, the U.S. Secretary of State at the time, and Prince Fahd, the second deputy prime minister and later king and prime minister of Saudi Arabia. So kind of what did they agree to? Exactly what they've done the last 40, 50 years. We would protect them militarily, which we've done. They would price oil primarily in dollars, not 100%, but close. And they'd buy treasury bonds. Oh, no, they never agreed to that. No, they just did it, right? Out of the goodness of their heart, they just did it. Now, of course, there was an agreement put in place, whether it was written or unwritten, and it looked like what most people are calling the petrodollar. And there have been major geopolitical changes since that make the arrangement maybe a little less desirable today. And most oil required dollars, but Saudi, as OPEC leader, is now beginning to look at accepting Chinese renminbi or other currencies in exchange for their oil. Look at the BRICS nations.
And many of these currencies are currencies that are buying lots of gold right now.
Correct.
China's got a lot of gold they need to buy still if they were going to ever have a complete true gold-backed type currency, but there are other countries that are going to a gold-type standard.
There are reasons happening right now that would cause Saudi Arabia pause. One of them is under the Obama administration and the Biden administration, we turned away from the Saudis and we turned to the Iranians. Do you remember when we had Claire Lopez meet with us in 2014? And she told us that was going to happen. It happened exactly as she said.
And Claire was a former CIA analyst.
Yes. Yeah. Well, she was, yes. We'll just say
and
she,
other things.
She worked for a certain three-letter agency that works for the U.S. government. Yeah.
Sharp, very knowledgeable.
Yeah. Wonderful lady. Anyway, so she made the point with us that under Obama, they were going to turn away from Saudi Arabia and turn to Iran. And certainly they did. And we sent piles of cash to the Iranians. And we signed an agreement.
Because they're such a good friend and ally.
Yes. And she told us they were going to do it. And then they did it. And then they said it was a rumor that it never happened. And then we saw photo evidence and it did happen.
Pallets being dropped out of planes.
Yeah. The U.S. government basically said, no, there's nothing to see here. No, it didn't happen. But it happened. And Saudi Arabia was upset. Then President Trump gets elected and he turns away from Iran, tears up the Iran deal and starts working with Saudi Arabia. And we get the Abraham Accords and peace in the Mideast. And then Trump is out of office and Biden goes straight back to Iran, puts it right back in place. So do you think Saudi Arabia has an incentive potentially to reconsider the arrangements that we've had informally with them for 50 years?
I would think if the right negotiator were on the other side, yes.
Yeah, things change over time. They have changed. And guess what? In walks Vladimir Putin, and he says, hey, Saudi Arabia, why are you propping up the dollar? Why don't you work with us on a BRICS currency? And the Saudis don't say no. They're open to it. In fact, they have potentially applied for a membership in the BRICS nations. 30-plus countries added to Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. And there is no question that the BRICS nations, I've got an article here from foreignpolicy.com, Foreign Policy, April 24th, a BRICS currency could shake the dollar's dominance. De-dollarization's moment might finally be here, says Joe Sullivan. bottom line is Saudi Arabia has to be considering that things have changed, and maybe they are willing to give up on the informal or formal 50-year-old agreement called the petrodollar.
Yeah, yeah. My guess is if they do that, they're going to rebrand it. It's going to be S-BRICS, because S and BRICS and S is South Africa, and if I'm Saudi Arabia, I'm doing this. I want to be
S-BRICS. S-BRICS. Yes. Maybe so. But the point
well,
is...
Well, let's hope it doesn't happen.
Yeah, let's hope it... Well, here's Jim Rickards. Jim Rickards now was the CIA expert on economic warfare when I was working in DOD. I never met him when I was working with the government, but I did meet him on a Glenn Beck program. He and I were both invited by Glenn. Glenn got sick and didn't show up, but his... fill-in host interviewed both me and Jim. I got to talk to him. He's an interesting guy. And he writes in the Daily Reckoning, and here's what he wrote on June 17th. The deal was never a formal treaty ratified by the Senate, meaning the petrodollar, which would rise to the level of the law. It was non-binding executive agreement. Let's learn what Jim Rickards had to say about the petrodollar. We'll have to look at it in detail and how it could impact you right after the break.
Pirate Money Radio, helping you give, spend, and invest in ways that align with liberty, security, and values. Welcome back with your host, Kevin Freeman.
And our good friend Mike Carter, who's here. Hey, Mike, did you see that Jim Rickards article from June 17th? I quoted it right before the break.
I saw it, and you got my attention before the break. I was like, I'm ready for this next segment. This sounds interesting now.
Yeah.
It was interesting before, the setup, the history, things I'd never thought about or heard about before, the way things are repeating itself. But now as we get into, okay, what's it mean to me today?
Well, the question was, dailyreckoning.com, did the Saudis just kill the U.S. dollar? Well, here's what he says about the petrodollar. We're talking about the petrodollar, and it's something that was put in place 50 years ago, 1974. Here's what he says. He says, the deal was never a formal treaty ratified by the Senate, which would rise to the level of law. It was a non-binding executive agreement, not much more than a written handshake. You know, so bottom line, Jim Rickards says, yeah, there's an agreement, and it was a non-binding agreement. It contained annual renewal provisions and could be terminated at any time by either party. The Saudis held up their end by pricing oil in dollars and buying U.S. treasuries. The U.S. held up its end by sending troops and repelling Iraq's invasion of Kuwait in Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm in 1990-91. The agreement suited both sides, and so it continued. The agreement never had an explicit expiration date, so reports that the deal has expired are overstated. The Saudis have notified the U.S. that they're not extending the deal, but that decision has to be put in the context of other U.S.-Saudi discussions. Everything we've said, he's validating. Informal, things have changed with the Saudis. We don't have a formal expiration date, but, you know, basically, I got to see how you treat us versus how you treat Iran.
Clearly, they're opening negotiations.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm sitting there as a leader, I'm like, all right, I'm going to toss this up, and we're going to see what the new terms are going to be.
And in fact, Rickards says that the U.S. and Saudi Arabia are currently in negotiations on a new financial security arrangement that would supersede the old petrodollar deal. The new agreement will provide that Saudi Arabia will recognize Israel as part of a broader Abraham Accords initiated during the Trump administration. The U.S. will continue to offer security protection to the Saudis, but those will be expanded to include uranium enrichment technology, which is interesting because we know that Iran is close to getting nuclear weapons. Yep. So we have to keep Saudi up so that they don't worry about getting run over by the Iranians. Ostensibly, this technology would be used to fuel nuclear reactors, but might later be used to build nuclear weapons. Saudi Arabia wants this technology because it feels threatened by Iran's own uranium enrichment capability. The latest Saudi action won't destroy the dollar. This is the key line. The Biden administration seems determined to accomplish that all by itself.
Oh, sounds like it's time for some pirate money.
Yeah, we're getting there.
All right, all right.
All right, so Jim Rickards wrote on June 24th, 1 week later, the weaponized dollar. I'm just going to summarize what he said. Jim Rickards basically said what we've been saying on this program. We keep telling other nations we're going to control you by the use of the U.S. dollar. We tell the American people we're going to control you by central bank digital currency, and we're going to control access to the dollar. So what did we do to Vladimir Putin? He invades Ukraine. The first thing we do is we freeze all his assets. And then we have recently said that we're going to take those frozen assets and give them to his arch enemy, Ukraine, which is stealing his stuff, right?
To supply them with weapons to be pointed back against them. Kind of like we do with China right now. We fund a lot of that stuff and they are pointing things back at us.
Yes, and they're going to buy the weapons from us. So, yeah. I mean, this is not the way to build friendships and relationships around the world. Sure, you can take Russia's stuff. Vladimir Putin's the thug. That's all right. He invaded Ukraine. But don't you think India and Saudi Arabia and others will start to worry that America will use our dollar as a weapon against them? If you have all of your currency held in U.S. dollars, and we have a history of nationalizing those assets, ending gold convertibility, confiscating gold from our own people, don't you think they're going to worry potentially that we're going, and that's why they're de-dollarizing. That's why the BRICS nations are expanding and growing. Here's a quote from Rickards. The story of the petrodollar's rise and reign began in the 1970s following the collapse of the Bretton Woods system. The U.S. negotiated a landmark agreement with Saudi Arabia. The foundation of the petrodollar system was laid in the aftermath of World War II. The U.S. emerged as a dominant economic power with a strong dollar backed by a large gold reserve. Meanwhile, oil-rich countries like Saudi Arabia needed a stable currency for their booming oil exports. A pivotal moment occurred in 1971 when President Nixon ended the convertibility of the U.S. dollar to gold, effectively severing the direct link between the dollar and its gold backing. Oil, the world's lifeblood, would be priced and traded exclusively in dollars. This is explained in 2024 Atlantic Council article, What the End of the Petrodollar Means. So all of that has come about because, and that's what we opened the show with, all of that has come because Saudi Arabia, global foreign policy, and the bottom line of what he said and what Rickard said was the Biden administration seems determined to destroy the dollar all by themselves. Hmm. So we've got that now. What do we do about it, Mike?
Oh, I was hoping you were going to get to this part.
All right. So what do we do?
Well, I think we got to focus on fair weights and measures, stable store of value, transactional gold and silver.
Gosh, you're talking pirate money on Money Radio.
That's an easier way to say it, pirate money.
Imagine that. Pirate money meaning gold doubloons and silver pieces of eighth in Article 1, Section 10 referred to the U.S. dollar or the dollar as the U.S. currency, which really meant a Spanish mill dollar, 0.7734 troy ounces of fine silver, as written in the book Pirate Money. And that's what the name of the program is based on.
What it means for me is the ability to easily now buy gold, know that it's going to be stored safely, have a transactional debit card where I can spend it anywhere I spend money now, and something that's going to keep its value, keep up with inflation. And I know it's not being eroded away or negotiated away somewhere else. To me, I'm excited about that. We're seeing the country excited about that, multiple states out there. And I'm really excited as we go into these next sessions with all these states that are reaching out to us now to see what happens in this next legislative session.
So basically what you're saying is that Richard Nixon took us off the gold standard in 1971. Franklin Delano Roosevelt took gold away from the American public in 1933. Reversing both of those, using the Constitution, letting states defend your right that is given in the Constitution to have sound money, gold and silver, and to use them at the personal level and essentially allow every American to do the very thing that every central bank on planet Earth is doing right now, and that's hold their money in the form of gold and silver. What would that do for me if I did that?
What would that do for you to be able to hold your money as gold and silver?
Yeah.
Well, I think—
Why would I do it?
Well, I think it gave you a little bit of peace of mind to begin with, right? Don't you want to keep your economic liberty and economic freedom? Wouldn't it be great to have money or fair values of exchange where you don't have to worry about people controlling how you spend it, what you do with that? Wouldn't it be great to be able to have something that we think potentially won't even be taxed as it does potentially go up in value, according to IRS code out there? Wouldn't it be great to have a state-backed system running this that kind of helps keep the federal government out of the way of this thing. So,
and it would deal with inflation, so yeah. I wouldn't have to worry about the dollar collapsing. There's so many. Proverbs 22:3 says that a prudent person sees trouble coming and prepares for it. A fool goes blindly on and suffers the consequences. We've just given you all of these economic upheaval situations happening right now today, just like they happened in the early 1970s when we had Israel at war, we had America funding a proxy war like we had in Vietnam that turned into a real hot war, and we're talking about maybe sending troops in to fight in Ukraine. We have, you know, all of these global threats, and then we had foreign governments wanting to dump dollars and go into gold. That was what was happening in the early 1970s. It's happening again today. Wouldn't it have been nice if our parents could have held their money in gold and silver, had it protected, not confiscated and all that? I think that's what we're talking about. We're talking about giving you the opportunity to have a personal gold and silver standard based on pirate money. Now, there are other things our government should do, but if you want to understand how to do all of this, you can get more information at piratemoneyradio.com, or you can learn about the book Pirate Money at piratemoneybook.com. That's for more information. But here's some other things. Federal government needs to stop wasting money. We already have $35 trillion in debt. We don't need multi-front wars. We shouldn't be forgiving student loans from students who got to go to college and making everybody who didn't get to go to college pay their student loans. We need to eliminate fraud and abuse in healthcare and defense. We need a sensible foreign policy. We need to stop weaponizing the dollar and demanding that other countries. Can you imagine you're India and all of a sudden the Biden administration tells you, if you don't fly the rainbow flag during Pride Month, we're going to cut you off from the dollar system. Do you put it past them? Do you think they could do that? I do.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Kevin, I was just reflecting back on, you know, De Gaulle sent a battleship, a warship to pick up his gold. And we talk about ships all the time here, but it's the small ships. And that's why we have Pirate Money Radio. We don't have battleships, but you're each one of the small ships that can make a difference.
Are we pirate ships?
Well, yes and no. But we're the small ships that can make a difference. And all of us working together, working with our legislators, making sure they understand what transactional gold is about. And you can learn more about all this at piratemoneyradio.com and transactionalgold.com. But a chance to really make sure that we have a shot of real weights and measures and all the benefits that come with transactional gold and silver. And so excited to have this opportunity to talk to our audience every week, bring them up to speed and get more of these small ships working together to make this happen.
Yeah. And so what you're looking at the headlines or you read on X or Facebook or whatever, you're reading the petrodollar system is ending and it's going to ruin America. Well, all right. So maybe that some of that's overblown, but there are real reasons that people are concerned. And a prudent person sees trouble coming and prepares for it. The way you can prepare for it is pirate money. Now, you may have questions about everything we've talked about. You can get your questions answered by emailing afr@piratemoneyradio.com. And we'll respond either back on a program or back by email. Listen, what we see as a marketplace, our enemies view as a battle space. That's our tagline for the Economic War Room show. And the problem is that most people don't know, what do I do if the petrodollar's done? What do I do? Do I run out and buy a bunch of gasoline and store it in my backyard? Not a good idea. I don't suggest that. But what you can do is plan ahead and be prepared. That's what Pirate Money Radio is here. We're here to help you do that, to take the headlines, make them simple, and tell you what you can do about it. Kevin Freeman from Pirate Money Radio.